You know, I'm listening to stories and reading stories about the killing of James McGrath, and I'm just stunned. You know, I think all of us with children, we used to hold our breath and hope for the best when they'd go out on the weekends. And I don't know about you, but when I'd hear that door open after I fell asleep on the couch waiting up and clicking behind me, I'd breathe a sigh of relief that we dodged another bullet. Mr. McGrath didn't. And we now learn that I believe a 16-year-old young man, Raul Valle, has been charged with murder in connection with the death of Mr. McGrath. And I gather he's been charged with assault, although I have not yet read this or heard this, in the stabbing of the three other people. That would, young people, I should say, that would put to rest a question that was in my mind, and that is whether one person was responsible for all of the stabbings. You know, as events unfolded, what we learned late last Friday night, there was a stabbing in a residential community, in a quiet residential community in Shelton. Police responded. Four people were taken to the hospital. Questions that came into my mind was there a fight, and people on both sides of the fight had been injured? If one person and one person alone is arrested and charged with all of the stabbings, that suggests there was no fight. It doesn't necessarily rule out the possibility that there was a struggle of some other sort and that the others involved weren't armed. That's an open question that Mr. Valle's lawyer, Jake Donovan, will have to answer. I wondered who would get the Valle case, and Jake was on my short list. There are probably half a dozen lawyers in the state that could handle it. None as well as me, but I didn't get this one, and that's life. But Jake is calm, he's seasoned, he's been around the block, and here's what he will do as he develops a defense of Mr. Valle. The first thing that is, you know, and I've heard plenty of people say, wow, why a $2 million bond? A seven-figure bond is not surprising in a murder case in Connecticut. The federal constitution under the Eighth Amendment gives people a right to a reasonable bond. But under federal law, there are cases in which bond can be denied as a matter of law. The courts can conclude that all, notwithstanding what the Eighth Amendment says, the purpose of bond is to assure that a person will present themselves in court to answer his or her charges, and that the community will be safe. Connecticut law gives a person a right to a bond. And thus, it's an open question whether a court can actually deny a bond altogether. In September, I argued a case in front of the state Supreme Court on a $20 million bond involving a young man who's accused of killing a Yale graduate student in a shooting on the streets of New Haven. And our argument was that given the family's resources, $20 million was no bond at all. It was the functional equivalent of saying you're going to be detained prior to trial. We went to the state Supreme Court on an emergency bond review motion. And now listen to this, and you should be concerned about this if you care about your liberty. We argued that case on September 8th, however many months ago it was. This man, my client, Quinjean Pond, remains behind bars on a $20 million bond. We've asked the state Supreme Court to review it and to determine that that's unreasonable as a matter of law. We don't have a decision. 8+ months. My client, presumed innocent, behind bars with a constitutional right to a reasonable bond. We argue it to the Supreme Court. They could at least give us the courtesy of a decision. But and the problem with that case is, you know, a $20,000 bond. Mr. Pan is has connections to China. He did not turn himself in immediately for arrest. Police believe he was fleeing, that his parents may have helped him. There's a suspicion that he may have been attempting to flee to China. So you're going to put on a heavy bond to make sure that he appears for trial. But when you let a $20 million bond stand as a matter of law in Connecticut, it creates bracket creep. And every other bond is going to scooch up a bit. Now, $1 million bond for a murder case, that's not uncommon in Connecticut. I've heard suggestions. I don't know whether it's true that Mr. Valle may have been detained even as early as or as late as late last week in North Carolina. I don't know if that's true. I've only read it in the newspaper. So if he had substantial connections out of state, that would justify a higher bond. Crimes of violence justify a higher bond. Whether he was potentially a danger to himself or others and might benefit from custodial care, that might be a factor that a judge would consider. But he was entitled to make a bond. Now, he was charged initially. He's taken into custody. as a minor, as a juvenile, rather, as a person who's not yet an adult, and we didn't know his name. I've heard people say, wait, what's up with the secrecy? Why can't we know his name? Well, that's the law, folks. When a juvenile is arrested, the law presumes that that person is not yet a fully formed and functioning human being. And we all know that kids do stupid things and they make horrible mistakes. And so the law gives juveniles the benefit of the doubt. It says we don't want a juvenile known forever by that one moment, his worst or her worst moment of their juvenile life. We want them to flourish as adults. And so juvenile records are sealed and are confidential, and the courtrooms are closed to the public so that we don't know the identity of a juvenile. They're not even called defendants, you know, they're offenders, you know. And so when a case is disposed of in juvenile court, it's claimed to be adjudicated. And when a child meets the terms of the sentence, whether it's treatment or whether they are remanded to a juvenile detention facility for a period, the record is sealed when they become adults. And it's though it never happened. That's the functional equivalent of in adult court, what we would call a diversionary program. Now, one of the ironies in the Valley case is, had he just thrown a water balloon at a house and broken a picture window, we would never know his name, because the juvenile law would protect his identity and say young people do stupid things, and when young people do stupid things, we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. What happens when a young person does a horrific thing, as Mr. Valley apparently, allegedly did in killing Mr. McGrath? Do they shed their status as juveniles? Do they suddenly become fully formed adults as culpable as you or I for these horrible acts and omissions? I don't think so. Neurologically, they're the same person. And developments in neuroscience tell us that, you know, a brain isn't fully formed. The frontal cortex, all that wiring between our ears that goes so far and such a long way in making us who we are, it's not all there yet. But yet we say of heinous crimes, of very awful crimes, murder, that we're going to treat juveniles as an adult. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not saying that if Valley did this, he's entitled to a pass, our congratulations, even our solicitude. But the same kid who could have thrown a water balloon through a picture window and made a stupid mistake might have made a stupid mistake in Shelton. But now he's been transferred to adult court, and he's going to be treated like a hardened criminal, like any 25, 30, 40, 50-year-old who did something like this. And my heart goes out to him. You know, here's what Donovan is doing. I listened to Lisa Wexler before, and she was wondering, you know, why the police hadn't, you know, and you ought to be listening to Lisa. You know, I mean, if you get a good dose of calm insight, kind of like the consummate Jewish mother welcoming you to her table, saying, come, sit down, let's talk, whatever you need. And, you know, I mean, I love Lisa. You know, I met her the other day, and I'm like, could I have your autograph? I mean, I'm going to get to sit in the same chair you did thereafter. But, you know, she was wondering, why haven't we seen videos yet? Well, the reason is that police have in what's called a privilege. They have a right not to disclose information in an ongoing investigation. This is called the law enforcement privilege. And while they're gathering information, they keep that information, or at least they have a right to keep that information confidential. That is to preserve the integrity of the investigation. Now, you can assume that if there were 50 or so kids at the event where Mr. McGrath and others were stabbed and Mr. McGrath was killed, that officers interviewed as many of the kids as would submit to an interview. You can further assume that they took the cellular devices or got copies of cellular devices with anyone who had the presence of mind to film this. It's probably safe to say that there are videos of the act itself and that those are in police custody. Notwithstanding our hunger to know what happened, to address the terrors that this inspires within all of us, notwithstanding the public's right to know, notwithstanding a concern for common decency and public order, the integrity of the investigation and Mr. Valley's right to a fair trial depends on management of the evidence. And so you will hear experienced law enforcement officers talk about crime scene integrity and about the integrity of an investigation. They want to preserve the evidence in the form that it existed at or about the time the event occurred, in this case the stabbing. They don't want people traipsing through morbid souvenir hunters looking for bloody rags to sell on eBay. And then they want to preserve the integrity of the investigation so that others can't use information they learn in public to make the case harder to prove or disprove. Because believe it or not, there are wackadoodles in the world, and not all of them are sitting in the White House. People will call and confess to a crime they didn't commit. People will call and say they saw things they didn't say. People will call witnesses, try to buy things from them. It is a horrible world. Spend 5 minutes in the office of a criminal defense lawyer like Jake Donovan sometime and listen to the phone calls that come in, and I am willing to bet you'll be calling your general practitioner asking for Xanax thereafter. It is a wild world. So here's what's going on in Jake Donovan's mind. He's got this young man. It's a high-profile case. Emotions are high. And he's already lost the first big battle of the case. I'm willing to bet that if Donovan were contacted over the weekend, his first call was to the state's attorney's office, and he gathered all of the exculpatory, that is, the good evidence that he could about his client, and presented it to the state's attorney with a plea that the case remain in juvenile court. So I don't know whether Mr. Valley, had any mental health issues. I don't know whether he had substance abuse issues. I don't know whether there was struggle in his family. I don't know what challenges he faced. But Jake's task would be to go to a prosecutor and say, look, notwithstanding the blood on the street, this young man is entitled to the protection of the juvenile justice system. That has failed. We're talking about the challenges facing Jake Donovan, the lawyer who has been retained, I presume, to represent Raul Valley. And I say I presume because Jake is not a public defender. In Connecticut, if you're charged with a serious crime and you can't afford a lawyer, you have a right to a lawyer. Connecticut was the first state in the United States to have a public defender system, and that is at almost no cost to you. There's a nominal application fee that will be waived if you can't make it. A lawyer, and a decent lawyer, will be appointed to represent you, especially in a serious case. If you want your own lawyer, and the Sixth Amendment gives you the right to your counsel of choice, and you can afford to retain one, you can hire anybody who will agree to take your case at whatever fee they will agree to take. Jake is not an ambulance chaser. After the 2008 financial crisis, experienced criminal defense lawyers were in despair because there were so many hungry real estate and commercial lawyers looking for work that there were lawyers with briefcases wandering the halls of the criminal courts who had about as much business being in criminal court as I would have in an operating room. I mean, give me a scalpel and everybody's dead, right? These guys would wander the halls of the criminal courts offering to take felony cases for $5,000 or $1,000. And a lot of people got the lawyers they bought and the justice that they paid for, which was no justice at all. And the court system is still sorting out many of those miscarriages of justice because some lawyers just don't know what they're doing. I remember sitting in law school one day, there were 70 of us in the class, and I looked around. I always used to sit in the back row because I was a troublemaker. But I know that's hard to believe. Me, calm, resolute, respectful of authority, always appropriate. I wouldn't be a troublemaker, but I did sit in the back, and we would walk out of class from time to time and raise raspberries when we could. But one night I looked around the room at everybody, and I thought, there are only about 5 people in this room that I would trust to handle a parking ticket of mine. Come graduation day, we were all attorneys, jurists, doctorates, and counselors at law, and some of them are still out there peddling the same mediocre talents that they had during law school. Jake was not one of those guys. He's always been a hard worker. I think he's about 70 years old. He's a bicycler. He's fabulously fit, and he's a fabulous cook. He keeps threatening to invite me to his home to have some of his home-cooked pizza. He's yet to make good on that threat. Jake, if you're listening, I'm interested. But what does Jake do now? Jake has this client, Mr. Valley. Mr. Valley's been accused of murdering James McGrath in the horrible stabbing out in Shelton. You'll recall Mr. McGrath is the Fairfield prep student. Now Jake's got to defend him, and he's charged, the top crime is the charge of murder. look, crimes are defined by statutes, by laws, and they have elements. There are things that need to be proven. The state must prove each element of a criminal offense to obtain a conviction. Thus, the crime of murder is having the specific intent or conscious objective to take another life and then taking a life. So murder would be walking into a room with a gun saying, I'm looking for Joe Blow. There you are, Joe, shoot, pointing the gun at Joe, pulling the trigger, saying, I want to kill you, Joe, and killing Joe. That's a pretty good murder case. There are lesser forms of homicide, though. All murder is a form of homicide, taking the life of a person. There is manslaughter with a firearm, where you act with extreme indifference to human life, as though you don't care whether the person lives or die, and you take a life. There is a different form of manslaughter without a firearm. There is even criminally negligent homicide, where you act with gross indifference to human life. And the difference between these penalties is significant. Murder has a range of penalties from a mandatory minimum of 25 years, and you do day for day. There's no parole or no good time on a murder case. So it's 25 years to 60 years. Manslaughter with a firearm, I think it's 40 is the max. I don't recall. I think it's five to 40. So there's a five-year mandatory minimum, a 40-year maximum. Regular manslaughter is a 20-year maximum, and then if you can persuade the judge to let you go home, you go home. Criminally negligent homicide is a one-year penalty. So what Jake will be doing now is he'll be gathering as much information as he can about what happened the night of the stabbing, and that will come in the form of police reports. Police will have responded by making reports on their observations. They will reduce them to writing. They will have interviewed all of the percipient, that is, eyewitnesses who were at the scene that they could get for the information they could gather. They will have taken written statements from some of these witnesses under oath. And Jake will be entitled to all of these things as a matter of discovery. The public, however, is not entitled to these things unless the court permits them to or orders that they be disclosed. If the young man was arrested pursuant to a warrant, that is, under the authority of a warrant, then that warrant will be filed in court, and that will contain a summary of those facts and circumstances that would lead a neutral and detached magistrate to conclude that there was probable cause or reason to believe that Mr. McGrath was guilty of the crime charged. That will become public. So Jake will investigate all of this, examine this, do a timeline. He may re-interview witnesses, and he'll be looking for evidence about what happened in the moments before the deadly violence that took place in Shelton that night. He'll also get as much medical information as he can about Mr. Valley to determine whether Mr. Valley had any psychiatric difficulties. He may pause to consider whether there was an insanity defense. A person can be not guilty by reason of insanity, because in order to commit a crime, you have to do these two things. You have to have the conscious objective, you know, in this case, murder, to kill, and then you have to kill. Suppose there's something, some infirmity where the person is mentally ill. Either they're so mentally ill they don't know what they're doing, or they are hearing voices in their head and have an irresistible impulse, or they can't conform their conduct to conform to the requirements of law. They could be found not guilty by reason of insanity. They don't go home with a fudgicle and a teddy bear at that point. They go to a forensic institution where they're held until they can be declared sane or not, and many remain there for life. Now, in Mr. McGrath's case, Mr. Valley's case, and my apologies to those who love Mr. McGrath, that was an innocent slip of the tongue. In Mr. Valley's case, I don't know whether there's going to be a mental disease or defect defense. There could be an intoxication claim. And if he was voluntarily intoxicated, that is, he got hammered, he was out there drinking with his friends and he got blotto, he would resemble an insane person. But that's not the same as being mentally ill. You don't catch intoxication the way you do a cold. Intoxication is something you do to yourself. The voluntary intoxicant may be able to defend on grounds of intent, that he lacked the ability to form a specific intention, but it's not a complete defense. So Mr. Donovan will examine the state of mind of Mr. Valley. He'll examine the circumstances. He'll examine the state of mind to determine whether there is a mental disease or defect defense, and likely there is not. He will then determine whether the young man was voluntary or involuntarily intoxicated. I mean, as preposterous as it sounds, suppose he was at a party and people were passing out roofie to disable the judgment and will of young woman. And, you know, Mr. Valley sipped from the wrong drink and didn't know what he was doing when he did it. That would be a sort of zombie defense, an unusual one. It would have integrity as a matter of law. It'd be a difficult one to prove as a matter of fact. He then will try to figure out what the events were that led up to the killing. And by the way, you know, you're listening to WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, WICC600.com. This is the Norm Pattis Show. If you've got questions about the McGrath homicide or what you're reading in the paper, give us a call at 203-333-9422. So the circumstances surrounding the violence are going to be where 80%, 90% of Donovan's efforts will be focused. What he's going to be looking for is an explanation that he can recite aloud as to why this stabbing took place. So bad news would be that there was a woman in common between these two young men, and that they had words because perhaps Mr. Valley was on the wrong side of a love triangle, and those words led to violence. That would give him motive and anger. Anger is a powerful motive. Jealousy is as old as the Old Testament, and that would be bad news, you know, for Mr. Valley. Suppose, on the other hand, that Mr. Valley was on the right end of a love triangle, and he was approached by supporters of Mr. McGrath, or perhaps McGrath himself, and there was a fight. Could Mr. Valley raise a self-defense claim here? The law of self-defense in Connecticut is notoriously complicated, and there are cases right now before the state Supreme Court, including one of mine involving a man named Shota Mekoshvili, about whether the self-defense jury instruction is so complicated that no juror in their right mind can find it. Can follow it, rather. In the Mekoshvili case, Shota Mekoshvili was picked up by a cab driver in Stamford one night at around 2 o'clock in the morning. Later that morning, the cab driver was found stabbed many times with many knife wounds, and Mr. Mekoshvili ran from the scene and was detained later. Mekoshvili testified at trial that he was sexually assaulted by the man in a cab, and that they struggled, and he struck back to kill himself. To kill the man in defense of himself. The jury was out for 2 days, and they rejected the self-defense claim. But here's what self-defense looks like as a matter of law in Connecticut. There are four things that need to be shown, and the state has to disprove each of these things to overcome self-defense as a defense. First, that the defendant, the person who did the killing, actually believed that the person in confronting him posed a serious risk of death or serious bodily injury to him. So did you have a genuine and honest belief that the person approaching you was going to do you that level of harm? Second, if you did, is that belief reasonable in the eyes of the jury? You know, in other words, were you behaving in a way that the community can accept? So lawyers refer to this as the difference between a subjective and an objective standard. So in terms of the perception of risk, that's the first thing that has to happen in self-defense. A defendant has to honestly believe he faces a serious risk of death or serious bodily injury. And second, the jury has to conclude that's a reasonable belief for the defendant to have had. If the defendant, if the state cannot disprove that, then they will go on to the next set of factors, and that is whether the force that the defendant used, the lethal force, was justified. And the first question resembles the subjective thing as to the perception of risk, and that is, did the defendant believe that the force he used was reasonable? So in other words, you don't blast somebody with a submachine gun who taps you on the cheek. You know, I mean, that's just ridiculous. So if the defendant had a reasonable if the defendant honestly believed subjectively that he could use that level of force to overcome the threat to him, okay, then he wins. Then finally, the jury has to conclude that society as a whole, they as members of society, are prepared to say that use of force was reasonable. if you listen to the last two or three minutes, you're probably thinking, what is Pattis smoking? And I don't smoke. And I'm not a crackhead. I'm just a lawyer struggling to make a living who's now trying his hand at talk radio. But I am telling you, that's about as simple a statement of the law of self-defense as you're going to get from any lawyer in the state. And this is why the state Supreme Court is struggling with it. They've not yet made a decision in the Mekoshvili case. So in the McGrath homicide, And in the Valley case, Mr. Donovan is going to be looking at the circumstances that immediately preceded the use of lethal force to see what must have been going on in Valley's mind and what was going on in the minds of others. So the police will be turning over such discovery statements and whatnot that they have. Eventually, Mr. Donovan will get videos. He obviously is spending time with Mr. Valley, interviewing him to get his take on events, to make an evaluation of Mr. Valley's state of mind. And, you know, let's just take the worst case scenario, because these things happen, folks. I mean, I'm in a cell block almost every week talking to somebody. And there are times where a person's world falls out from beneath their feet so rapidly that they lose hold of the common things that nourish us all and sustain us day to day, their family, their hopes, their expectations, even their self-respect. And from time to time, you'll find a client who you believe is an imminent or immediate or near risk of harm to himself. At that point, you may put the client on suicide watch. And, you know, that's a difficult thing to do to a client. Because they're observed closely, they're deprived of everything but the blanket over them. The lights are kept on, and people look in on them every 15 minutes. Many years ago, I had a case involving some horrible allegations of child sex trafficking from a man who suffered congenital disease and was from another country and had no right to be in the United States. So he was facing a long period of incarceration and then deportation to his home country, where he had no family left, and he had diminished health prospects. So he, you know, was suicidal, and I put him on suicide watch, and he was pretty angry, and he survived, and we talked again, and he was suicidal again. So I put him on suicide watch, and he survived. And when it came time to decide what to do, you know, I was asking what he wanted to do, and he suggested he might be afraid to talk to me for fear of what I'd do. And, you know, I said, what do you mean, you suicide watch? And he said, yeah. And, you know, and it was a tough situation. His situation was so bleak. I mean, suicide almost seemed reasonable at that point, as horrible as it is to say. But in the Valley case, it's possible that this young man needs medical health treatment right now, or mental health treatment, and that Mr. Donovan would make such a move. He'll then evaluate, obviously, his state of mind. And there's a difference between competency to stand trial, that is, the ability to face trial, face your chargers, face your accusers, and assist your lawyer. That's competency. There's a difference between that and the mental disease or defect at the time of the offense that might make you not guilty by reason of insanity. So Jake will sort through all of that. And, you know, he'll do that with the toolkit that lawyers have, which is no toolkit at all. Just your intuitions and your experience. You'd be surprised. There are no courses in law school on mental health. You know, and just Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., a former justice of the United States Supreme Court, wrote a famous book called The Common Law. I'm going to guess around 1882, 1883, but I might be wrong by a decade or so. And in it, he said, you know, one of the things a lawyer does is he helps his clients bargain within the law's shadow. In other words, there are legal doctrines that are set in, not in stone, but in writing. And then there's the wiggle room as the doctrines collide. A lawyer's job is to know the law and to provide counsel or advice to their client about what their client can expect the law to permit them to do or be done to them. That's all fine and dandy in the Victorian world. Most lawyers these days know that the shadows, the most predominant shadows that are cast in a client in a courtroom, are coming from within the clients themselves. And sometimes those shadows are so deep and dark that they threaten to swallow the client and the lawyer with them. And you just don't have any training for this. So Jake, however, is experienced. He's seen it all, done it all, and he'll know how to handle Mr. Valley. Difficulties with self-defense in this case could be initial aggressor problems. What am I talking about? Self-defense could be a complete defense to a charge of violence, but it has to be justified. The law says if you are the initial aggressor, in other words, you pick the fight, and then you end up killing your antagonist, your adversary, to survive in the fight, you don't get the benefit of self-defense. So context matters. There are also unusual cases where people agree to fight. They agree to engage in combat. If you agree to engage in that sort of combat, you don't get the benefit of that. Then there are Connecticut does not recognize a doctrine called imperfect self-defense, where you've made a mistake about perceiving the threat, but you're nonetheless entitled to self-defense. So these are complicated legal questions that Donovan will be evaluating in the next 30 to 90 days. In the meantime, what he will try to do is put the brakes on the proceeding to give everyone a chance to calm down. The enormous public interest in the case right now will make it difficult to settle. He will try to buy time for people, frankly, the general public, to lose interest and find another tragedy to attach themselves to. And then he will engage in plea bargaining with the state. And, you know, there'll be charge bargaining. That is, he'll try to get the state to come off the charge of murder. That is, to substitute for murder a lesser offense like manslaughter, so that Mr. Valley faces something less if he pleads guilty than a full 25-year mandatory minimum or 60-year maximum sentence. That may or may not succeed. In the end, most cases plead. I believe in Connecticut, 93% of cases resolve by way of plea. So it's foreseeable that this case will. And then there are different forms of pleas. There are what's called Alford pleas and straight guilty pleas, and then nolo contendere pleas. And an Alford plea is a plea where a person says, look, I'm not agreeing that I did what the state charged, but I know that if the state proved what it alleges, I'd be hurt far worse than the plea bargain I'm being offered. So I'm entering an Alford plea of guilt. A nolo contendere plea is a so-called no contest plea. It's similar to an Alford plea. You know, I'm saying, you know, I'm not going to contest the charges. The significance of that plea in particular is if you enter that plea will be recorded as a guilty plea, but it cannot be used against you in a civil proceeding. A straight guilty plea, I did it, I'm guilty, you know, have mercy on me, judge, that can be used against you in a civil proceeding to disastrous consequences. The case is unlikely to be resolved for 18 months to 2 years. That's my prediction. Right now, there's tremendous public hunger to resolve the case and to find out what happened and to hold someone accountable, because we're all angry about what happened to James McGrath. James McGrath was all of our sons, out for an evening with friends, not returning home, left to die in a pool of blood. And there is no gainsaying the anger that everyone feels and is entitled to feel. The criminal justice system's responsibility is to resolve these life-defining, horrific disputes in a spirit of calm, dispassionate resolve. And it's going to take time for the public to calm down. The McGrath family, at this point, undoubtedly is in shock. They have a right as members of his family to be heard as victims, and they have a right to be heard at every critical stage of the proceeding. In the courts, there is an office known as the Office of the Victim's Advocate. The victim's advocate will speak for them if they cannot speak for themselves because they're too distraught, and it will inform them of the court proceedings. But they will be heard about whether there's a plea. They will be heard at the time of sentencing. And at the time of the sentencing, the judge will consult what's known as a pre-sentence report, a report done by a court officer, that will be a complete history of Mr. McGrath and the facts and circumstances surrounding the crime and the impact of the crime on the survivors. And he will use that, or she will use that, to fashion an appropriate sentence. So, you know, that's a quick roadmap of where we're heading in the McGrath case.